This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, author Viney Burrows joins us to talk about the recent resentencing in the case of Lynn Stewart.
She's shocked by the 10-year sentence and shocked by the real terror that goes on every day in this country among the poor.
We'll talk with activists who've been arrested for doing civil disobedience, direct action to prevent a coal mining mountaintop removal effort.
It's one effort, but in fact, hundreds of mountains have had their tops removed, polluting entire environments. These heroic young people and others have been engaging in civil disobedience.
Stay with us.
Heidi, I know you have an update on what we referred to, or what is called the Jailhouse Lawyer's Handbook. It's a book that we, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Lawyers Guild, send to inmates all over the world, all over the country rather, prisoners, telling them what their rights are in prison, etc. And it's authored by a National Lawyers Guild staff person, Ian Head, who now works at the center as it happens, and Rachel Mirapol, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we've been doing this for a number of years, sending out thousands and thousands of issues of the handbook to prisoners all over the world. It's quite good for people to see. But recently we've had a problem with it, Heidi. And what's going on with it?
Every month, members and volunteers from the Guild and the Center get together. They actually get together every week to mail out hundreds of copies of this handbook. It's wildly popular with inmates. It's very readable. It lays out everything in terms of if you want to bring what we call a Section 1983 claim against prison officials for bad conditions, mistreatment. And quite by accident, we found out that it has been put on the so-called disapproved list in the state of Virginia, the Department of Corrections there, meaning that for some reason or another, they find that it's inappropriate for their inmates to have. They did not notify us, which is one of the claims in the lawsuit, that due process was violated because they are supposed to let you know, the publisher, when they put you on this list, and they didn't do that. But the issue is that we don't see any reason why it is considered, as they said, quote, detrimental to the security, good order, discipline of the facility or offender, rehabilitative efforts, or the safety or health of offender staff or others.
Well, you could argue that knowing your rights basically jeopardizes what they can do to people. Because if you know your rights, they're going to say, you can't do that to me. You can't throw me in isolation for X days. You can't take away my commissary privilege for Y. So I gather that this is giving inmates their rights, and therefore they don't want people to have their rights.
I think that's precisely what it is. It's threatening to them. Really, I must say that the demand is so enormous that we're kind of just staying afloat in terms of sending out the ones that we can. We try to send them all, but it's the more we send them, the more news spreads among the population.
The name of the book again is the
Jailhouse Lawyer's Handbook.
And how big is the book?
Well, it's not a book, actually. It's an 8.5 by 11 paper. It must be a little over 100 pages, but it's printed on fine newsprint. Otherwise, it would be much larger. So we've tried to economize. The cover, for example, is just on newsprint. They share them with other inmates. You know, we've talked about jailhouse lawyering as a practice that the Guild and CCR is very supportive of. And in fact, we know of many cases in which jailhouse lawyers have brought successful suits by educating themselves in prison and by helping others.
Now, jailhouse
to know
lawyers
their
are not technically lawyers. We call them jailhouse lawyers because they actually have an understanding and an ability to help themselves as well as others by filing all kinds of petitions and writs and complaints. And it's an important component of the work in prisons to protect people's rights. And the Guild, to its credit, and I remember when it happened, the Guild admits as members of the Guild jailhouse lawyers. And we have a vice president, or is that
we
right?
We do. Mumia Abu-Jamal has been our jailhouse lawyer vice president.
Correct.
I should mention that he was helpful. And I know that Ian and Rachel sent him drafts of the handbook before it was published. He provided a lot of support in that respect, and he has also told us how important it is. We should mention that the lawyers who have brought the suit in Virginia, and it was filed in the Western District of Virginia last Wednesday, July 21st.
By the Center and the Guild.
By the Center and the Guild are Jeff Fogel, who is in Charlottesville, and his law partner. We look forward to having the Jailhouse Lawyer book back in the correctional facilities of Virginia.
Now, if people want to have a look at how to get the book or where to go or something about the lawsuit, what are the websites?
There's nlg.org.
And ccrjustice.org. Both of them have information on the Jailhouse Lawyer's Handbook as well as the recently filed lawsuit. I imagine we'll prevail. I mean, here you have 49 states allowing it into their prisons and Virginia. And hark back to its old status as a Confederate state. But the other thing about Rachel Mirapol and Ian Head, who are with the authors of this book, as we speak, they have just come back from West Virginia. They have gone down for the Center for Constitutional Rights to work on the issue of mountaintop removal for CCR and some others.
Michael, is there any update on the military commission for Omar Khadr?
Well, there is. Omar Khadr, who our listeners may recall, was 15 years old when he was arrested in Afghanistan, supposedly for throwing a grenade at some American soldiers, killing one American soldier. Of course, he had been there with his father, who was now, I think, dead, and was an admitted al-Qaeda person, and had taken his boy, who was 15, to Afghanistan. And they were in a village or in some kind of place, and the Americans attacked. And the only survivor turned out to be Omar Khadr. And he was then accused by the military, or the U.S., of killing a U.S. soldier by throwing a grenade. But of course, at 15 years old, he's considered a child soldier and should never have been tried, charged, or anything. He should have been rehabilitated and given a special kind of treatment under the treaties that the U.S. has acknowledged and signed and under others. Yet the U.S. is insisting on trying him for murder. And of course, he's been at Guantanamo now almost 8 years. He's 23 years old now, and now they want to put Omar Khadr before a military commission. He's a Canadian citizen, and the Canadian government has really totally caved to the U.S. throughout this eight-year period, including probably interrogating him and other big issues with him. The Canadian courts have been much better, and not once, but four times, have essentially ordered the Canadian government to request Omar Khadr's repatriation to Canada, partly because he was a child soldier, partly because he was tortured, and partly for other reasons. But now, this wonderful Obama administration is going ahead with his military commission trial at Guantanamo. And I recently received a rough draft, really, of part of the proceedings that went on at the military commission recently, on July 12th of this year, a few days ago. And it's from Guantanamo Bay. And the issue in this now is Omar Khadr is now saying he is going to dismiss his civilian lawyers from Canada and all his other lawyers, and he doesn't want to attend the trial. And there's a dialogue between him and the judge. It's too long to read it all now, but it's one that's titled, when I got it, Who's On First? Gitmo style. Not if people remember the joke. There's an old sort of joke of who's on first. I don't remember the whole thing the way it goes. But it's just going back and forth. And that's what's happening with Khadr and the judge. The judge is named Colonel Patrick Parrish. Here's what Khadr says. He explains his reasons to the court. Your Honor, I'm boycotting this military commission because, firstly, the unfairness and injustice of it. I will not take any plea offer. He was offered a 5-year plea instead of 30 years because it will give the excuse for the government for torturing and abusing me when I was a child. In other words, he's saying that, look, I was tortured and abused when I was 15 years old, and if I take a plea, it'll basically say they were right in trying to torture and abuse me to get a plea. Judge Parrish didn't seem to really understand Khadr's statement, and he started to question him. Will you represent yourself, etc.? And then he says to Khadr, have you ever studied the law? Khadr says, this is a military commission. You don't need to study the law. Judge Parrish then says, what is your education? Khadr, 5 years in the military commissions. As if the judge knew nothing about his background, he then asked Khadr, have you ever represented yourself or anyone else in this type of proceeding? Just remember, he was 15 years old when he was captured. He's been in the U.S. custody for 8 years. Then the judge says, are you familiar with any rules of evidence? the judge says, are you familiar with the military commissions? With no apparent appreciation for the irony that the rules had materialized after Cotter's pretrial hearings were already underway. Cotter answers, in general, my lawyers are as untrained as I am. No one has any experience in these military commissions. The judge asks, because before you can let someone represent themselves, the judge asks Cotter, do you have any mental or physical issues that would prevent you from making these decisions about representing yourself? Cotter answers, this place is not a five-star hotel, so I'm sure it's going to have an effect on me. I don't know. Anyway, it goes on and on like that with trying to get the judge to figure out, is he going to let Cotter represent himself? We don't know what's going to happen, but the case is just an example of a complete outrage, complete outrage. As I recall, there was one part of this, I'm not sure it was with Cotter, where they had part of him in a cell, and they showed some of the video of him as a young person, and it was just pathetic. So this is what we're doing. Even assuming he was guilty, which I actually have no sense that he was, if someone said, let's say he's guilty. Let's say as a 15-year-old, he knew that he had what he had been doing, and let's say he had not been brainwashed since he was 8 by his Al-Qaeda father. Let's say his action was unprovoked, that the prison guard reports he was well-behaved or just hogwash, and that he's basically rotten to the core. So what this writer says, his name is Lawrence Martin, even if this were all true, any self-respecting society that believes in the principles of fundamental justice would not respond to his case the way Canada has. Omar Cotter has been held 8 years without trial, and I should say not just the way Canada has, but the way the United States has. As someone, a former Justice Minister of Canada, said, this trial will be the first of a child soldier in modern history. That's the United States, that's Canada, and that's our current administration. As many listeners know, Lynn Stewart, who has been on this show often, has recently been sentenced to 10 years in prison. It was a resentencing in which a 28-month sentence was raised to 10 years. Many of us, many of our listeners and others, are very upset by this sentence. Among those who were in the courtroom that day was the well-known actor Vinnie Burrows. She's the UN representative for the Women's International Democratic Federation and a founding member of the Granny Peace Brigade. Vinnie will be our guest today. She has made powerful statements in her article titled, Lynn Stewart Heard a Death Sentence Today. The article pulls together the broader issues involved in Lynn's sentencing. As Vinnie writes over and over again in his remarks, the judge used the term terrorist enhancements. Those warning words bring up the specter of the nastiest aspects of the Cold War and its present reincarnation in the Patriot Act, which by expanding law enforcement surveillance and investigative powers represents a significant threat to civil liberties. Vinnie Burrows, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Love being here and love the title and love the work that you do. Very necessary.
And Vinnie, I know you were at the sentencing of Lynn Stewart and you've written a piece on it. So why don't you talk to us a little bit? And we have Michael Smith on the phone as well calling in.
Well, I suppose what I should say, it was useful to be there, to see the players, to see the judge, to see the two prosecuting lawyers, and then also to hear Lynn Stewart, who made a marvelous warm opening statement, which I hope was recorded. And if it wasn't recorded, I know it has been transcribed so that could be a very useful fundraising. It was one of the great speeches before the bar. It's going to go down in history. It's that important.
Yes, it brought tears to my eyes, really, and I'm sure many other people.
But you know, Vinnie, we should have seen it coming because Lynn asked the judge for some time and apologized and said that her statement was a little bit long. And the judge said to her, you take all the time you want.
Yes, he did.
And the reason he said that was he already had decided the sentence. Mm-hmm. He didn't listen to her. And then he went on to talk about what a fine example she was in the community, working for the oppressed and poor people for 30 years, being a teacher in Harlem, the huge amount of support that came out for 400 letters, which he said he read every one. And then he laid it on her, didn't he?
The sledgehammer.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, I felt as he was reading that he was responding to each dictate of the appellate court. I would love to see what they sent him, because I'm sure that every clause, every issue, he responded to, in a sense, taking personal blame from himself, saying that he was simply obeying the dictates of the appellate court.
But they were very harsh, the appellate court. We can send you that. Mm-hmm. It's a public opinion, and it's true that they put a hammer on him. That's
well,
correct.
Well, maybe because he was, I don't know how long he's been a judge. I don't know what his ambitions are. I think that this attorney general, like Ashcroft, and also because I looked up just before I left the house, like Mitchell Palmer and the Palmer raids, which did the same thing. It's a repeat of those people, those immigrants, those aliens. They are a clear and present danger simply because of their status, not as human beings, but because they are classified in a certain way.
My thoughts exactly, Viney. I remember when I was sitting there, it was the same court that sentenced the Rosenbergs half a century ago, sentenced two parents of children aged 3 and 6 years old, knowing they'd be orphans, and sentenced them to death for the same reasons that they laid that 10-year sentence on Lynn Stewart.
Mm-hmm. We have to define terror, you know. I mean, we cannot go by what the legislative and, I guess, the executive and certainly the judiciary now defines as terror. We're looking in the wrong places for terror. We should be looking in the highest offices and the highest reaches of the land for the true terrors. You tell a single mother of 3 children who has no place to live and is in a shelter, she knows terror. When she doesn't know where her next meal is coming from, that's terror. When a home is foreclosed, when people are bought into the American dream, suckered into, assuming the kind of debt that they should never have assumed, but were suckered into it. Those were the terrorists. And, of course, our banks are the biggest terrorists of all, so that we cannot even think of Lynn Stewart when we talk of terror. She is a human rights defender. And it seems to me that maybe her lawyers should think about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, take that as a position, that she was at risk and is at risk because she defended the human rights of her client.
Viney, you, more than anybody, should know that you're the United Nations representative for the Women's International
yes.
Democratic Federation
mm-hmm.
at
mm-hmm.
the UN. And I think bringing a human rights and international law aspect to this is really very helpful. I think also what you said about we should also define terror. I mean, who, after all, is the greatest instrument for terror in the world? It's the United States government.
Yes, and its policies, both domestic and foreign.
Now, Viney, I can ask you a little bit about what your reaction was in the courtroom, but first I want to ask you, you wrote a piece that has been circulating, and first, what's it called, and talk about it or read us a small section of it, if you could.
Oh, I certainly could. You know, I mean, I'm an actress. It's like asking a shoemaker to make a shoe. You left yourself wide open. I don't know whether I want to read it all. It did come out of, I think there's certain sections that are important, and I titled it, Lynn Stewart Heard a Death Sentence Today. We're talking about a 70-year-old breast cancer survivor with multiple health issues impacting on an already vulnerable and aging body. Lynn Stewart, who has spent 30 years defending poor, oppressed, unpopular clients, it has to spend the next 10 years of her life, as the judge said, 120 months away from her life partner, husband, life partner, her adult children, and her numerous grandchildren. Now, the judge made a very lengthy statement saying that he was following the dictum of the appellate court, which demanded that he review the 28-month sentence, which he, after great deliberation, handed down.
Huge deliberation, yeah, thousands of letters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talking about what Lynn has done in her life and her world and giving her that sentence initially.
And now backing away completely from that on the dictate of, we must say, you know, the Attorney General. And if we talk about the Attorney General, we have to talk about the executive head of the government.
I agree.
So continue
with your piece.
All right. Over and over again in his remarks leading up to the sentencing, the judge used the term terrorist enhancement. I had never heard the phrase before. That's why I wrote it down in my... and then that night when I was writing, it called up for me the specter of some of the nastiest aspects of the Cold War and its present reincarnation in the Patriot Act, which by expanding law enforcement surveillance and investigative powers represents a significant threat to civil liberties. You have only to read the title of that act, Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. Well, you know, I think we have to go back to the definition of what is terror and who are the terrorists and who are those who are victims of terror. And as I said, you know, I have a piece in my program about women, about a single mother who is on welfare and lives in, shuttled about from shelter to shelter. And she knows terror because she doesn't know where her children will sleep that night. She doesn't know what school they will go to. She knows that they will not be able to establish any real relationships with children in the classroom because they don't know how long they will be in that classroom. So she feels terror. She feels terror in her womb. And who are the terrorists? We have to talk about the state, you know. The state is normally the perpetrator of human rights violations. Yeah. I will go back to what I had
to say. That's very important perspective because we all focus on, quote, what the state tells us is terror. But in fact, ask the people you're describing or ask others in the world what the terror is of this state.
Well, now past and sometimes and present White House administration believe that by surrendering our freedoms, we are buying national security. So I want to tie national security and terrorism. Fighting terror has become a buzzword, allowing us to accept heightened police presence and militarization domestically and abroad has kept us in two costly and unwinnable wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, the verdict in Lynchwitz's case, and I'm returning again to my blog, should tell us that our country's policies are still set in a miasma of confusion and controversy. Human security should mean full employment, jobs and health care for all, affordable housing, mass transit, improved and restored national infrastructure, education for all, the welfare of the old, and the protection of the young. Those are the solid and only bases for true national security. And what rankles most in the Patriot Act are those provisions that sweep normal criminal law enforcement under the loose procedural standards for fighting terror. It's important and vital that the state be able to fight terror. No one disputes that, but it's equally important that the state does not use the war on terror to gut the warrant requirements, undermine the First Amendment, and try to dissolve our basic liberties. The state must recognize that poverty is a weapon of mass destruction.
That's great. Repeat that. That's amazing. That's a remarkable.
State must recognize that poverty is a weapon of mass destruction that brings terror to millions of our people. And recognize that banks and financial institutions, under whatever names they now call themselves, and oh, what a crock that is. These are harbingers of terror with foreclosures, planned closing, environmental devastations like the BP Gulf of Mexico debacle. The death sentence imposed on a 70-year-old woman has sent a message that the term terror, terrorism, can be used to stifle dissent, to silence voices, to let the powers that be trample over the rights of ordinary citizens. Those of us in the police movement, the anti-war movement, the anti-racism movement, the environmental movement, the movement for a just immigration policy must continue these struggles. This is what Lynn Stewart wants us to do. Her sacrifice will not be in vain if we continue these vital grassroots movements for a just and humane society. We owe that to our beloved Lynn Stewart, the people's lawyer. Lynn, we've got your back. La luta continue. Your sister, Viney.
Well, that's really
that's beautiful,
Viney. And it's really important to give people perspective on really what terror really is in this country.
I also, and I don't know if I mentioned on air, I might have mentioned while we were talking, that I find it most interesting that we can go back to Attorney General under Woodrow Wilson, that racist U.S. president. And I can talk another time about
But you should
that.
Mention what the Palmer Raids were, because some
yes,
of our listeners may not know.
He was an attorney general who decided, because at one point there had been a bomb exploded near his home, that he would round up almost 4,000 people and deport them as aliens, as immigrants, as non-Americans. Emma Goldman was one of those who was swept up in that.
I didn't realize. I knew Emma Goldman was deported, but I didn't know that
was
the raid.
She was part of that. And we're seeing the same thing now. The nastiest provisions of the Patriot Act, the nastiest provisions of Homeland Security. And I use that word deliberately with all the that it implies about venom and vitriol that is imparted on a state agency on people, on human beings. I think I told you that, you know, I consider, as other people do, but I consider Lynn Stewart a defender of human rights. And she's been deprived of the ability to defend human rights. She was at risk and is at risk with 120 months simply because she tried to defend the human rights of her client. So I think that she needs to be, we need to talk about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and as a legal basis on which to mount some sort of an appeal. I mean, that is, I'm not a lawyer and I don't know these things, but sometimes those who are outside of juridical, you know, disciplines, just a woman who is a mother and a grandmother, I even say a great-grandmother because I am, we can see what is clearly obvious to anybody, that our sister, Lynn Stewart, is in the position she is now in because she defended the human rights of her client, another human being.
Well, exactly. You know, when she did what she did, which was to issue a press release for her client, and there was a ban against that, and in retrospect, Lynn said, you know, I should have challenged that ban in court.
Like Ramsey Clark
violated
did.
You know, but nonetheless, when she did what she did under the Clinton administration, they didn't do anything. And then Bush got elected, and they didn't do anything. But then 9/11 happened, and all of a sudden they're looking for a scapegoat. They want to selectively prosecute somebody to scare the pants off lawyers so they don't go representing people that they denominate as terrorists.
Yes.
And then
yes.
they picked her up, and John Ashcroft flew into New York and got on the David Letterman show, and he should have been sanctioned for this. Any other lawyer would have. And he publicly declared that she materially aided terrorism. He made it impossible for her to get a fair trial. Mm-hmm. And that's when they started after her. And when the judge gave her only 28 months, he was ordered by the superiors of his in the Second Circuit to more than quadruple that sentence is what he wound up doing. And again, she was selected out and made an example of to do exactly what you said, to kind of terrorize people and back them off and encroach on their human right of free speech.
I think your point about the Palmer Raids and is really important, and that Michael and I have been talking about, you know, the use of terrorism really is the new communism. Yeah. And the way under anybody who had any relationship to progressive movements, to liberal movements, to communism, you know.
Anarchism. I think of Sacco and Vanzetti.
Was just slaughtered during those different periods. I mean, just the sentences imposed. That's really, if you look at Lynn's case, they just, a 10-year sentence, I mean, for conduct that took place in a different administration before 9/11, I mean, against someone who's been demonized by the society, it's completely and utterly amazing. But it fits the paradigm of the Palmer Raids and the severe sentences. We had someone on the show the other day whose father got 65 years in jail for running the biggest Muslim charity in the United States, the Holy Land Foundation. 65 years.
Incredible.
First jury had actually not been willing to convict. Second one did. 65 years. Here, Lynn, 10 years after getting initially 28 months. Mm-hmm. What was the time? The Dalton Trumbo book, A Time of the Toads?
Yep.
I mean, this is this is a time of the toads. I mean, this is really a time in which the country has gone psychotic on this issue.
Well, we have still have to do something about it.
That's where we are. So yes. Now your idea you suggested, of course, is which is something that we lawyers look at, is international human rights and how those work. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Lynn has another appeal now that she'll be undergoing because of the severe sentence. Mm-hmm. And then I'm sure there'll be international tribunals that we try and have her case looked at because it is a very, very severe sentence, really. I mean, amazing to me.
Well, as you said, I think, or maybe Michael said it, the Lynn Stewart case has been lifted out of obscurity because of 9/11. Otherwise, it would have just have...
There would have been no case.
Yes, there would have been no
footnote.
And
I wouldn't be here, right? No, I mean...
And then that institution of the elite in this country, the Second Circuit, which is the second most important court in America next to the Supreme Court, because it presides over the financial
court.
Empire... Judge John Walker, you know, George W. Bush's cousin, wrote an opinion saying that he thought that 28 months for Lynn was, quote, shockingly low. Now, this guy is part of the ruling elite. His family made their money selling munitions during World War One, and this is where they're coming from. This is the policy they're making, that they're going to severely punish and terrorize people like Lynn. To intimidate all the rest of us.
Well, it's important that we lift up, you know, and show these toads or these worms or these serpents that wherever we go, those of us that know and those of you who are listening to this program should be empowered to realize that an appellate court, someone who's sitting in the appellate court, made a statement which, in effect, condemned. Now, isn't that against the law?
Yeah, it was really irregular for doing what they did.
Irregular.
You're going to have to rule on that.
You can be irregular with your bowel movement, not irregular with
you've given us one suggestion. What else? I mean, you've been writing on this. People can go to your website, which you should talk about your blog.
I would like to ask you, what about the question of a pardon? Where would a pardon come from?
It would have to come from the federal government, from Obama.
And who might be running for a second term.
Who's in charge of this whole
right.
operation.
And who
is
running for a second term, as the judge is thinking of his upward mobility in the judicial system.
And, of course, we have other people we want pardoned by Obama as well. I mean, we have Leonard Peltier sitting there forever, and Mumia. Mumia's state, but still, that's a governor could pardon him. So that's certainly, but those are all things that, they're going to have to be campaigns. The thing we have to understand is we are not going to let Lynn die in prison. I mean, hopefully she'll live longer than 80 years, but 10 years is a very long sentence for a 70-year-old woman.
What do you both, I speak, you know, to Heidi and also to you, what do you suggest that we, as the public, do? What can we do?
I think first we have to continue to write op-ed pieces like your wonderful blog, and let the rest of the country and the international community know what has happened and put it into the scheme of this whole terrorism farce that's been going on. Because a lot of people aren't aware. They don't know who Lynn Stewart is. So I think education and public outreach comes first, and then reaching out to the humanitarian legal community, as you've mentioned. I think international law, definitely.
I also think, you know, when I think about Lynn, and I traveled to California with her on a speaking tour maybe a year or two ago, and also I've done speaking with her here. As I said, I don't think she should have been prosecuted at all for this. But when I used to speak, the people who came out for her, hundreds of poor people, minority people, all kinds, because she in her community was so well loved. She would represent everybody for essentially nothing, from evictions to petty crimes to all kinds of stuff. And I think when the judge originally gave her 28 months, while I think she shouldn't have been prosecuted at all, when he gave her the 28 months, he was taking into consideration that this is a person who has dedicated her life to helping the poor, the disenfranchised, and those terrorized by poverty, as you said, Viney. And I think that's an important message for people, that this is just an outrage what happened here.
Well, then we have our work cut out for us for the different organizations, the different groups, the different associations we belong to, whether they are professional associations or housing associations, labor, of course, women's associations, whatever it is, we have to make Lynn Stewart's case really our Joan of Arc case.
Well, thank you, Viney. Yes, and tell us how people want to read your work.
Oh, well... You can go to my website, which is Viney Burrows, VineBurrows.com, and see who I am, and then you can get in touch with me there. And if you write me, I will respond. I always respond to communication.
Really,
this was
a joy
really an
to
honor
have you
to hear
on.
You. It was
yes.
really special. I mean, you
well,
know.
Thank you. Thank
I mean,
you.
We
very
followed
much.
Your career for a long time, but to hear yes. you read and speak, oh my God, your vibrancy and your politics, what can I say?
Thank you. Well, we shall continue doing what we know must be done for the world. So I thank you, Heidi.
Thank you for coming to the studio. Viney. And Michael Smith on the phone.
Well, Viney, thank you very much. It's really great to be with you, and keep on fighting.
All right, all of us.
Thank Cheers. You. Bye-bye. Great, Viney.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Freedom fighters, speak with your tongues, sing with the might of the wind in your lungs. Do you hear me now? Do you hear me now? Peace, love, and women, single or wed, give thanks for the mercy of a child with one head. Do you hear me now? Do you hear me now? My mama told me, Papa said it too. Son, the world's divided and you know your cause is through. Do you hear me now? Do you hear me now? There's snowmen in the winter, blossoms in the spring. If they drop the bomb in the summertime, it won't
Last week, four activists with Climate Ground Zero and Mountain Justice were arrested for using direct action to shut down a coal mining mountaintop removal effort in Virginia. Two of the four activists locked themselves to heavy machinery in the coal mining pit and were later arrested. They say they were drawing public attention to the dangers associated with the Brushy Fork sludge impoundment, which contain up to 8 billion gallons of toxic coal waste. The area is unstable, and Brushy Fork's foundation is built on a honeycomb of abandoned undermound mines. If the foundation were to collapse, as others have, the toxic slurry could engulf communities nearly 14 miles away, according to Marfork Coal Company's emergency warning plan. Meanwhile, one of the activists, Jimmy Tobias, remains in jail. To get more detail, we are joined by Dea Goblerish with Climate Ground Zero.
Dea, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Where are you located?
Right now I'm located in Whitesville, West Virginia, in the Coal River Valley.
And what are you doing there?
For the past year or so, I've been working on campaigns to end mountaintop removal in Appalachia.
What does that mean, mountaintop removal?
So mountaintop removal is an incredibly destructive form of coal mining that uses explosives to blow up the tops of mountains and gets to the coal seams beneath. It's cheaper and more efficient than underground mining. It also employs far fewer miners. So there are far less people employed as miners in Appalachia than there were when mining was primarily underground. And as part of this process, mountaintop removal not only flattens peaks. So far, there's been over 800 miles of peaks that have been flattened, which is an area that, if you stretched it from New York to the San Francisco Bay, would be a quarter mile thick. They also take all that rubble from blowing up the tops of mountains and dump it into nearby valleys, which are called valley fills. And the creation of the valley fills covers up a lot of the headwater streams that run down from the mountains. And a lot of these streams feed into water systems that bring water to the entire eastern half of the United States. So filling in these headwater streams is causing, like, toxicity in water, high levels of lead and pollutants and heavy metals.
I understand that one of these areas is called the Brushy Fork Sludge Impoundment.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to have, what is it, 8 billion gallons of toxic coal waste?
Brushy Fork is the largest earthen dam in the Western Hemisphere. It can hold up to 8 billion gallons. We're not quite sure how many gallons are in there right now. There's no way to get that information. The estimate has been about 7 billion gallons, but this dam is huge. And if it were to break from a face break, which is the face of the dam, crashing through and not being able to hold back water.
Right.
By Massey Energy's own estimates, it would kill 998 people.
The area is unstable there, isn't it? The foundation on which Brushy Fork is built? And there are underground, abandoned underground mines under it?
Brushy Fork is built over, like, what you could conceptualize as a honeycomb of abandoned underground mines held up by mine pillars.
And is there a risk that that foundation might collapse?
There's absolutely a risk that that foundation might collapse. It actually hasn't been investigated by any agencies because it's unsafe to send anyone down there.
Catch us up a little bit. I mean, I think I have a overall, I mean, without seeing it, I've seen some pictures and what the devastation really looks like and how horrible it is. But can you catch us up a little on the campaign? Who are you with? What are the different elements of the campaign? How do you expect to stop it?
I work with Climate Ground Zero, which is a campaign of nonviolent civil resistance to mountaintop removal.
That's called Climate Ground Zero?
Yes. The campaign in West Virginia started in February of 2009, which is before I was down here, with a lockdown on Coal River Mountain, which is where the Brushy Fork Slurry Impoundment is located. And Coal River Mountain was the last high-elevation mountain in the area that hadn't been mountaintop removal mined. Right now, work has begun on one of the permit sites, the Bee Tree Permit.
And that's on that mountain, is that right?
It's on that mountain.
So you mean to say when I look out at mountains, these are like the foothills of the Appalachians, I guess, right? These mountains. And when I look out at mountains and I see like normally green on top and trees and they look nice and they're different tops and all this, when I look out, I only see now in where you are one mountain that hasn't had its top blown off. Is that right?
Yeah, and you can't always see mining from the roadside. They tend to keep a veil of trees between the roadside and the mines. And there are certain ridges and peaks that are still intact. But a lot of these mountains have been mountaintop removal mined or strip mined in different parts of them.
The campaign now, so you've been down there for a while, and it's going to, there's different elements to it. There's obviously a civil disobedience element. Is there a lobbying element? And what's your sense of how it's doing and what the population down there is thinking?
So the Climate Ground Zero campaign is not connected to other organizations that are fighting mountaintop removal that choose to not engage in civil resistance. And so the work we're doing is primarily civil disobedience and direct action. Over the past year and a half or so of doing these actions, we've seen an increase in media attention. We've been able to get people involved, pull people in, and sometimes those activists who come down to do, you know, sort of the flashy direct action work stay on to be community organizers to work with other organizations, which is really powerful.
Can you give a few examples of what kinds of actions have taken place?
Yeah. So one great example of a direct action we did, well, we've done it twice. We've done two tree sits, and the first one was on the edge of the Ed White permit site, which is in the Coal River Valley. And the second one is also in the valley, and it was on Coal River Mountain.
So people would be in the trees and refuse to move?
Yes. Be in the trees within like a certain distance of the site so that the site could not blast. There's a certain radius that there can't be people in because then blasting becomes dangerous. Positioning people in those trees, and during the first tree sit, they held ground for about 5 days. During the second, two of the tree sitters were in the trees for 9 days, stopping blasting on their respective parts of the site that they were sitting in.
Now, what happens to the people? They get arrested? What are the courts down there like? Are people in jail for this stuff?
It's widely uneven. So we've had everything from people getting, you know, bond options of $250, $350 to, after an action blocking the road to Massey Regional Headquarters in Boone, West Virginia, in May, two activists were given $100,000 bails. And so there's this sort of like wildly uneven thing with the setting of bails and bonds. Those bails were eventually brought down. The case went to circuit court, and the circuit court judge in Boone dropped it down to $2,500 with a $2,500 bond option, $25,000 bail. And then in terms of sentencing, that's also been widely uneven. We've seen people with comparable charges getting everything from $100 fines to 60 days in jail without a way to appeal that.
If people want to know more information and or want to consider contributing or giving to the bail fund, et cetera, where do they go? You have a website?
Our website is climateground0.org, And people can go on that site and they can check out our actions and they can donate, learn more about what we're doing. And we have links on that site to learn more about mountaintop removal.
The community that's there, you mentioned that a lot of people have lost their jobs already because of mountaintop removal. But one question that gets raised when I mention this to people, they say, well, what about people who work in mountaintop removal? Aren't they just going to lose your jobs if Climate Ground Zero is successful? And what's going to happen to all those people?
That's a great question and a really, really tricky question. And one way that activists who are fighting mountaintop removal have begun to address that is by starting like sustainable energy initiatives and alternative economic initiatives in Appalachia. And we see this happening in Kentucky, in southern West Virginia, and in southwestern Virginia, which are all part of the coal mining regions of Appalachia. When we're asked this question, like, what's going to be here if we don't have these strip mining jobs? A lot of us are trying to ask it by working with amazing community leaders who want to build up other industries, sustainable industries that can employ people. And it's going to be a long, hard road. We've only started with very, very few projects. And, you know, taking on coal companies that have had a hold on this part of Appalachia for over 100 years is an incredible challenge.
Have the community leaders that you mentioned ever been threatened for their actions?
Yes, definitely. That's definitely happened. I can think of two instances which ties in a way to this whole like jail bail sentencing issue, is that there was a woman who slapped Judy Bonds, who is the director of an organization called Coal River Mountain Watch, at a rally in front of Marsh Fork Elementary School last June. Marsh Fork Elementary School is a school that is right next to a coal processing plant, and right above it sits a slurry impoundment, this Chumate sludge dam. And there's been a huge fight to move the school, which was recently won. We have enough money now to move the school to a safer location within the community. But last June, that wasn't the case. And at this rally, Judy Bonds got slapped by someone on the pro-coal side. And this woman received a $100 fine for her actions. And we also had an instance up on Cayford Mountain where Larry Gibson, who's probably the most famous activist against mountaintop removal, lives, where a strip miner threatened to slit the throat of a child. And like as a result of that, I believe he was given 6 months probation and maybe a $50 fine. Polly was released on a $1,000 bond.
We applaud you for doing this really courageous and much needed work and look forward to hearing some more positive updates in the near future.
Yeah, thank you, Dia. Your interview was great. And if you see my friend Jimmy down there, say hello.
I will. We'll definitely send good words when we talk to him next time he calls from jail. And everybody should go on our website and find out how to write to people in jail, because we have 3 people in right now.
Right. We'll do
Thank
that.
Thank you, Dia.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We'll also speak with Katie Husha, who was part of the action and was just released from jail.
Katie, we've just been talking to Dia about Climate Ground Zero and the whole campaign. And I understand that you just got out of jail. So what's that about?
Yes, I just got out of jail Monday afternoon after locking down to a high wall miner on the B-tree permit to shut down work for 4 hours.
What does that mean?
Me and 3 of my friends walked onto the B-tree permit on the mine site and walked up to the high wall miner that was extracting coal from the high wall but was currently turned off. And me and Colin Flood attached the high wall miner for 4 hours so that they would no longer be able to work the high wall miner. And then our friends Sophie and Jimmy were there in support to talk to police for us and miners and to kind of help things go smoothly. And the 4 of us were arrested and put in jail in Beaver, West Virginia.
How long were you in for?
I was in for 5 days.
But what's going to happen to you? I understand. I followed this a little bit because, as I guess you know, Jimmy Tobias, who's I guess remains in jail, is one of my son's very best friends, and so I've been in touch with them. But I understood the charges were like there were 3 misdemeanors against you, I guess, and $2,500 bail. And what's happened in that case, in your case and the others?
Well, me and Colin were both charged with trespassing, conspiracy, and obstruction. And then Sophie and Jimmy got the same 3 charges as well as a littering charge. I have a preliminary hearing on August 2nd. I haven't heard if the other 3 have dates or not yet. But
so you were let out on bail, is that it?
Yes.
I got it.
Not on bail.
We don't know what's going to happen yet.
No, not yet.
And Jimmy remains in jail. And who else?
All three are still in jail, Jimmy, Sophie, and Colin.
And how long were you chained to this piece of machinery before you got arrested?
About 4 hours.
Were you frightened when you did this?
It was a little bit scary, but I think that we were all four very solid in our reasons for doing it, and were able to stand very strongly behind our actions, and that took away from the fear a lot. The love of those mountains helped a lot.
Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Littleton, Colorado.
You know, what's interesting to me about it, because, again, because of Jimmy's relationship to my son, you know, I've been arrested a couple of times myself, but they've been very different. They're, you know, they're sort of set up. We go to jail for a day because we're protesting Haitian refugees being deported or the Central America wars. But this one, you know, when I first heard it, you know, the courts down there have, not necessarily in your case, but in cases, give people significant jail time. I mean, 20, 30, 40, 50 days. Sort of a big deal, I think, for particularly for younger people.
Yeah, from what I know of past cases, they have become a little bit more harsh with us every time that an action takes place. So sentences have been becoming longer and fines have gotten higher.
And how long have you been down there for?
I've been in West Virginia for about 2 months now.
And the 2 months you were there, is this your first arrest?
Yes, this is my first arrest.
And what were you doing before then, learning the situation or what?
Yeah, well, I'm actually a college student still. I go to James Madison University, and that's where I started to learn about mountaintop removal. But since I've been in West Virginia, I've been going to see sites and talking to community members and just kind of informing myself as much as I could.
How many people are sort of working actively on this right now down there?
At this particular camp?
Yes, and that you've come into contact with as you move around.
So the majority of this summer, I'd say there are probably like 30 to 40 people actually at this camp actively working to fight mountaintop removal, but there are a lot of other areas of support. So I think that the numbers are pretty high of people working to fight against mountaintop removal.
What was your main reason for getting involved in the campaign and for deciding to do it by civil disobedience?
Well, when I first learned about it, I think I almost didn't really believe the people who were telling me about it, that something so destructive and awful could actually be taking place so close to where I was going to school and that I could have not even known about it. And then when I saw the site, it was just heartbreaking and really kind of tore me up inside when I learned a lot about these mountains and how unique they are and all of the plants and animals and insects that are here and can't be found anywhere else. And I got to know some community members and got to experience the culture of this place that is very unique and unlike any place else, and really fell in love with it. And then I got to learn about the campaign and the fight that's been going on for years and years and all the work that everyone else has done. And we've tried every avenue, tried like to do it legally and to just raise awareness and to mark down all the violations and take that up with the DEP, and we've tried all those routes and just hasn't really seen quite the results that we've wanted. And I think that civil disobedience helps to bring more attention to it, and just kind of, especially because a lot of us are from out of state, and so the people that know us from home and aren't aware of this, that maybe they'll start to be interested in it and learn about it themselves, and we can gain more people in the struggle against it. I don't know, it's just another avenue to fight this, and I think that they're all equally as important and work together.
Has the media been down there covering some of the arrests and acts of CD?
At least this one was in the local newspaper. I got to read about it when I was in jail and see our wonderful mugshots on the news. And I talked to a reporter yesterday from, actually all the way from Pennsylvania. So I think that it's gotten a decent amount of media coverage.
I wish I could just come down and help you out there. It sounds like a just such a worthwhile effort.
As you said, I think the positive is that people like you are getting, engaging in civil disobedience, getting arrested or others, and it brings attention to us who are friends or have in other states and all of that. And I think that's very important because most of us wouldn't have known much about this campaign. But what about community involvement? And I know it's some of the people being arrested are outsiders, but I think there's community support as well. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. The people around here have been very supportive. When I got out of jail, a lot of the people who lived around here like came over to see me and, you know, just to say thank you and to show their support. And I guess while we were in jail, some other people actually brought over some food for the rest of camp to show their support. And they are very supportive, like, all throughout the year, not just during actions, and have been very, very friendly, and the community members here are why we're here, that we've come to help them, and they've just been really great, and they also help as much as they can in the actions, but a lot of them can't actually fulfill an arrestable role, because I don't think that's something that many people really can do.
We want to thank you so much for joining us, because you're doing really important work down there.
All right, thank you very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.